Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the session. On this rather pleasant day in comparison, Saturday here in New Orleans. The two presentations we have, of course, in this room are classically oriented. The first one is as you see up here, says Phantoms of the Opera, concerning the New Orleans opera archives. And then we're also going to have, after that, a memorial tribute to Don Hodgman, who most of you, if not all, remember him being here last year, and unfortunately had passed away at the end of last year. I want to introduce George Dansker, who's going to be giving our first presentation. He writes for Opera News magazine and has written articles on music, theater, and dance for the Times Picayune. Thank you, Dennis. That's why I always make sure Dennis is here to correct me. He is the production coordinator for the New Orleans Opera Archive Compact Disc Series and has lectured for the National World War II Museum and the New Orleans Opera Association. He is a graduate of Tulane University and Louisiana State University and is currently employed as a medical coder for the Ochsner Health System after a career as a librarian that spanned over 20 years. Today's presentation came about due to the kind invitation of Seth Winner, whoever that guy is, who knew of his work as the go-between for VAI, or Video Artists International, and the New Orleans Opera Association. His presentation will cover the fascinating history of the New Orleans Opera Archive Compact Disc Series that now numbers more than 17 official releases. And I just want to tell you, you're in for a real treat this morning, because George has also promised a surprise that I didn't even know about up until a few minutes ago. George, please take over.
Thank you for that nice introduction. It's a pleasure to be here. On my way over here, I thought of something regarding this archive that I'm going to share with you at the end of my introduction, and it's something that sort of puts, for us here in New Orleans, the entire archive in perspective. The New Orleans Opera Archive Project has been a part of my life since 1993, and I'm very happy to share my experiences with you. It's been an amazing experience for me to work with this archive, and the bottom line is how happy it has made not only the singers themselves when they learned that these tapes actually existed, and also, of course, the many people who bought the commercially issued CDs that came from our archive. You might call the archive a sort of a grassroots-level archive. The folks who made the tapes were doing it really for their own enjoyment and to trade them around. And literally, you could call it grassroots because one of the prime tapers, actually the man who had wanted to call himself the Phantom of the Opera because of all the recording he had done through the years, he described to me that after the Thursday night performance with the Opera Association, he would invite the singers to his house. He would play the tape of the Thursday night performance while he served a barbecue meal to them on the patio. And while he was playing it, he was making copies of the reel-to-reel tape to give to them. That's how laid back, that's how casual it was. It was really just to share and trade these wonderful performances. I don't think they thought they were creating any kind of a performance legacy, but of course they were. And I'm sure they didn't think very much about the legacy they were creating when you think of how the tapes were stored throughout the years. We found them in closets, in basements, in garages, in attics. And there was no time when a tape that we needed to look into for issuing as a compact disc, there were no times that we found the tapes were actually harmed in any way by the way that they were stored. So it's a great tribute to the durability of magnetic tape. But it was a small group of people who made the tapes, and then, of course, some very forward-thinking individuals with the New Orleans Opera Association, and also our friends at Video Artists International, who agreed to be part of this project and issue the performances commercially. They shared our enthusiasm from the very beginning, and we are very grateful to them for this. When we started cataloging the tapes, we discovered a very large cache of performances by Metropolitan Opera artists in what would be considered their signature roles. And because they were Met opera artists but not Met performances, there existed the possibility of issuing them commercially. And to our delight, we found in our archive the first performance of a singer in a noted role, the last performance of a singer in a noted role, a particularly wonderful performance that just had to be released. And very interestingly, because of the French heritage of our city, we have in the archive, and I just have to list them, Carmen, Thais, Pearl Fishers, Mignon, Sanson et Dalila, Lakmé, Faust, Romeo and Juliet, Werther, Manon, and Tales of Hoffmann. In the 1950s and 1960s, these operas were not being done as much, especially by the regional companies, and this is part of our archive, no doubt due to the French heritage of our city. The New Orleans Opera Archive also demonstrates so beautifully the performance standards of our company, as we have tapes in a range of more than 20 years. And it is also, in a way, indicative of the performance practice of opera in the United States. And by that I mean traditional cuts that may have been taken in operas or maybe entire arias that were never performed until more recent times. And this is another reason why the archive is so special. Outside the Metropolitan Opera broadcast for the same time period, I really would be hard-pressed to name another opera company whose work is so well documented and for such a long period of time, particularly a regional opera company such as ours. Now, as I mentioned right when I began to speak, that this was an archive that was to be shared, and we have shared. When singers have asked us for particular performances, sometimes I've made a tape and sent it to someone as a complete surprise. I sent Frances Yeend a performance of Turandot and got a letter back that she had long since given up ever finding a complete performance of herself in that role, and we had it in our archive from 1958. But the story that I wanted to relate to you again about the sharing aspect is there was a woman who retired from one of our local music schools this past summer, and as a little surprise, I didn't know her, I prepared a couple of excerpts of her performances with the opera. She sang the compromario parts, such as the priestess in Aida or Berta in The Barber of Seville. I made a little CD and sent it to her as a surprise, and I got a beautiful letter back. And she said she had no idea these performances existed, and it added tremendously to the joy of the occasion. During the conversation, she said, "Could you possibly find this performance and that performance?" So I said, "Sure, I'll work on it." Now, I was getting ready to go on a summer vacation. I said, "I don't really need another project to work on," but I'd also heard that the particular singer in question was gravely ill. And that was why she had retired from the job. So I made a CD, sent it to her. I got an email from her daughter that the entire family had gathered, and the grandchildren and great-grandchildren had never heard her sing before. They didn't know what her voice sounded like as an opera performer. They had a little party, and then I found out a few days later that she had passed away. And to me, that makes the entire work of the archive, the 17 years that I've spent with it, so worthwhile, because it is about sharing our musical legacy. And so this morning I'm here to share the story of the archive with you. The recordings were made by members of, believe it or not, the opera administrator staff, by chorus members who would run to a tape recorder hidden somewhere and turn it on and then get in place to begin the performance. They were persons with knowledge of top-notch recording equipment, and they also had the funds to purchase what must have been very expensive recording equipment at that time. And our recordings feature some of the finest voices of the 50s and 60s, just to name a few: Jussi Björling, Zinka Milanov, Dorothy Kirsten, Richard Tucker, Norman Traigle, Beverly Sills, Leonard Warren, Mario Delmonico. These are all part of the New Orleans Opera Archive series. We started issuing the compact disc recordings in 1994, and the last one was issued in 2006. They are in the United States under copyright control, but it always surprises me when I go to Europe to go into a CD store in Germany and find that they have been lifted and are on different labels that I've never heard of, but I guess I have to consider that a compliment because I know that the New Orleans Opera Archive series is not alone with having that happen with recordings being issued in different parts of the world. To begin with a brief history of opera in New Orleans, we have an incredibly musically rich history, as New Orleans is certainly known for its jazz. For people who know our operatic history, it's also just as well known. Opera has been performed in our city since 1796, and many U.S. premieres of operas took place here in the 19th century. Lucia de Lammermoor, Norma, The Barber of Seville, there are many more, Rossini, other Bellini and Donizetti, they all had the United States premiere here, and probably one of the theaters where it might have taken place is not too far from where this hotel is standing. We had many beautiful theaters, including the famous French Opera House, which was standing from 1859 to 1919. And here's a picture of the French Opera House. If you've been walking around the city and you go to the corner of Toulouse and Bourbon Street, you will see that the street widens at that point. That's where the theater was. And my dear friend Lewis Hall, whom many of you probably know, he issued a wonderful CD called From Bourbon Street to Paradise, which were collections of 78 RPM recordings that were of noted artists who appeared at the French Opera House. Unfortunately, this opera house burned down in 1919, and it was a good number of years before an actual opera association was created in New Orleans. The present New Orleans Opera Association was formed in 1943, and the company performed at the Municipal Auditorium until the 1972-73 season. All of the tapes in the opera archive were recorded during performances at the Municipal Auditorium, with only one or two exceptions. And these exceptions are performances of Norman Traigle. One of the opera administrators was a great fan, friend, admirer, almost a mentor to Norman Traigle, and he would pack up portable tape recording equipment to record Traigle in other theaters other than the Municipal Auditorium. But with these very few exceptions, everything was taped at the Municipal Auditorium. It's a very nice venue. It suffered a lot of damage after Hurricane Katrina, and it is being restored as we speak. It's actually two theaters, a larger theater and a smaller concert hall. The operas were generally performed in the smaller theater, and sometimes big spectacles such as Aida were performed in the larger side of it. In 1972, the opera moved to the Mahalia Jackson Theater for the Performing Arts. And again, that theater was very heavily damaged in Katrina. The basement area flooded, and all the electronic equipment was down there, things to move the curtain and the orchestra pit and everything. But it was beautifully restored and reopened just a year ago with a gala performance with Plácido Domingo and then a fully staged opera of Bizet's Carmen. Again, I think it's very fitting that it was a French work that was chosen to re-inaugurate the theater. The first recording of the New Orleans Opera Archive tapes were actually from AM radio broadcast. I talked to Alan Altman at VAI and asked him if any of the tapes that he has actually had radio announcements on them, and he seemed to think that one or two of them did, but they, of course, were removed when the recordings were issued on compact disc. I have never heard any radio announcements on any of the tapes prior to 1953, but they definitely were broadcast on the AM radio, and you can see I have a little ad that was shown in the program indicating that if you couldn't make it to the opera, that you could listen at home to that particular performance. In some of the production photos of the opera, microphones are clearly visible. I guess you could call it hidden in plain sight. I think that would be the expression that were used. And you will see them usually on the proscenium, and sometimes you will see them actually at the edge of the stage. We later used these photographs in anticipation of having to defend a threatened lawsuit about this particular archive, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. But actually, I have a photograph. photograph of the microphones. This is a 1959 performance of La Bohème. The singer is Giuseppe Di Stefano. I'm sorry, it's a little blurry, but I did a zoom in of the mic, and you can clearly see it. This performance of La Bohème we did issue commercially, and there's also a little bit of a mystery involved because apparently Act 4 was televised locally, and the kinescope absolutely has vanished. No one has ever been able to find it. But considering that the cast was Di Stefano, Licia Albanese, and Giuseppe Valdengo, it would be wonderful to locate it, and who knows, maybe someday it will show up. The archive itself is approximately 200 reel-to-reel tapes, and as I mentioned, they were stored for years in hall closets, never under climate control, but now, thanks to the courtesy of Loyola University, they are stored in archival and climate-controlled conditions. The archive is not complete. There are tapes in private hands, persons who have no intention of returning them, and perhaps returning is not the best choice of words because the persons feel as entitled to having these tapes as we do as to having them a part of our archive. Let's say they have no intention of sharing them. But on the other hand, people have been incredibly generous. When we were getting ready to issue Carlisle Floyd's Susanna on compact disc, we had some problems with the original recording, and we asked around, and suddenly I had 9 different versions of this performance on reel-to-reel tape. Unfortunately, I think they were all copied from the same one, so the flaws came with every single tape that we had, but it was nice that people were willing to be so generous. The archival content is not digitized, and there is not a complete online catalog of what is contained in the archive. I wish that there were. I wish it would be as simple as going to an online catalog, clicking a link, and being able to hear excerpts from this performance. Maybe someday we will. At this point, we're just very grateful that the tapes are being archivally stored. About a year or so ago, we did try a project with Loyola to get some student workers to start digitizing the tapes, and we had a server purchased, and there was all sorts of meetings and discussions. Nothing too much ever came of it. It was a little too labor-intensive, and I don't think the Special Collections Archive at Loyola was willing to commit to that, but maybe someday in the future. This is a picture of some of the tapes that are up there, and you can see that I had sometimes a complete performance date and theater and even some of the cast members. I would have that to go on, and sometimes the tape is just a blank box. But throughout this entire project, I had the good fortune of having a complete opera annals, a complete performance history of New Orleans opera. So if I knew what the opera was, then I could start piecing together who the singers were on this particular tape. Now, you might ask yourselves, what started the whole interest in going after the commercial aspect of the tapes that are in this opera archive? And there's a wonderful kind of corny expression, but a picture is worth 1,000 words. And if you get my little subtle or not so subtle in-joke, the recordings were starting to be pirated and sold on other labels here in the United States. And I will never forget one day I was in the opera offices, and the general manager of the opera at that time, Arthur Cosenza, was laughing uproariously because he had this Madame Butterfly in his hand, and he said, "I didn't sing this role, I didn't sing that role, and this was not that cast member, and this was not that particular date," and so on. And so he was amazed that the performance existed. He was amazed that it could be purchased down the street at Tower Records. And he was also amazed that they couldn't spell his name right or get the name of the role that he sang correctly. At the same time, with this conversation with somebody also in the opera offices, and he said to me, "You know, we've got a whole closet full of tapes. And a couple years ago, somebody started putting them on cassette, and they're just sitting there in a box. I know you're a librarian. Why don't you take some of these tapes home and give them a listen?" And I know this sounds very simplistic, but basically, that is exactly how it happened. So from hearing about this performance of Madame Butterfly that was issued on compact disc, I went to a closet, literally in the old Masonic Temple building, pulled out a box of tapes, and because I have particular favorites with singers, I spied a Cavalleria with Zinka Milanoff, and I spied a Falstaff with Leonard Warren. I put them in my pocket, took them home, and that began the New Orleans Opera Archive. The cast members were not listed on the tape, but I knew that Milanoff had sung in 1963 and Warren in 1956, so I had pretty much knew that these were the performances that I wanted to hear. At the time I was working on the New Orleans Opera Archive project, I had two jobs. I worked daytime with New Orleans Public Library and nights at Loyola University. And I do confess, I guess they can't come after me now, that I did a little, I guess you would call it double dipping, because when I was at Loyola at night, I was at a very quiet reference desk, so I would start listening to the tapes when nobody was around and start cataloging them, making little annotations. Then I would finish listening when I got home, and sometimes it was 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and when I would make a fantastic discovery, I'd have to wait till the next day to share it with somebody. But there were two tapes that I listened to, and I call it the ah moment or the wow factor, and this was what got me to really go to the New Orleans Opera Association and basically convince them, plead with them, that these tapes needed to be made public. The first excerpt that you will hear is Zinka Milanoff's 1963 performance of Cavalleria Rusticana. This was the last Santuzza of her career, and it's also a good indicator of just how wonderful she sounded after a career in opera that had lasted more than 40 years at the date of this recording. Because I had heard that maybe at 1 o'clock in the morning, I had to wait till at least 7 a.m. before I started calling friends and playing that for them over the telephone. But when I heard this, I said, this is phenomenal. This has to come out. And what you hear on this CD is pretty much what the original tape sounded like. And for people who are just doing this for fun, the capturing of the voices is truly amazing. Unfortunately, in 1963, every tape that we have from that season is in mono because there was a burnt-out microphone, and I don't think they knew it. They weren't looking at the levels on the tape recorder too strongly, so there's just a channel of hum on all the performances from that time period, and eventually they caught it and rectified it. So the Cavalleria Rusticana should have been a stereo recording, but unfortunately it wasn't able to be. One other wow factor or ah moment with the operas is when I first heard it was on cassette, the tape of Leonard Warren in Falstaff. This was a very rare role for him. He only sang it a few more times after the performance in New Orleans. He was absolutely marvelous in it, and I heard how beautifully his voice was captured in its absolute prime, and I started to put together in my head a list of what should be the first issues of this opera series.
L'amore che non ci dà mai tregue finché la vita strugge con me l'ombra che chi fugge insegue chi insegue fugge. L'amore, l'amore, l'amore.
I'm going to back up a slide just to talk a little bit about what was involved in cataloging the tapes. Often, as I mentioned, the tapes had complete information, meaning the name of the opera, the exact date of performance, whether it was the Thursday night, whether it was the Saturday night. Sometimes there was nothing. Sometimes the tape would be labeled Tosca 1957, but it was really Tosca 1952. And what helped me tremendously was that I had access to this complete performance history, and I had what I think is a pretty good ear for identifying the singers and figuring out exactly what particular performance I was cataloging. When we started to talk to VAI about issuing the tapes, we found, much to our delight, that there wasn't a whole lot that had to be done to get them ready to be issued on compact disc. Pitch was corrected, and that could be corrected fairly easily. Most of the time, they were low in pitch, if they were pitch problems at all. Occasionally, as with the Beverly Sills Tales of Hoffman, it played sharp. Generally, the pitch was okay. Very seldom did we have to alter the pitch from one act to another. Hum was a frequent problem, and they easily got rid of it. Hiss was another problem. I remember when I first heard the Manon with Montserrat Caballé, it sounded like instead of on the road to La Havre, she was at the seashore, because the hiss was so strong and pronounced, but they did a very good job of getting rid of it. And then those of you who are tape enthusiasts, I think it was Ampex was the company that the tapes had to be baked. And we had one tape that was on Ampex, and yes, it did have to be baked, and it came out just fine because it had that, I think they called it the Ampex squeal on it. But that tape was absolutely rescued. Speaking of Manon, I remember going to a party, and someone said to me, "You're miles away. You're not even paying attention to anything that's around you. What are you thinking of?" And I was saying, I'm thinking, which night of the Manon has the violins more in tune? That's how consumed I was at that moment with this project, but it was certainly a lot of fun for me, and still is. In 1994, we had our first announcement, and the announcement, unfortunately, brought with it a lawsuit. We were very pleased with the announcement when it came out in the paper. That's the original opera offices and the Masonic Temple building with some of the tapes on the floor, and I think the closet where they had been stored was just around the corner. We thought the publicity was going to do great things for the project, but one day I came home from work and I had a message that said, "George, you're being sued for $1 million. Click, and then the phone hung up. So it was again late at night. I had to wait until the next day to find out what had happened. But basically, there were some people who had played in the orchestra, and they thought they could get millions and millions of dollars from this lawsuit. So basically, not being a lawyer, I prepared what I guess you could be called a legal brief. I used the picture from La Boheme that I showed you earlier, and I talked about how the singers knew that the performances were taped, they had, you know, shared their enthusiasm and so on, and then they produced, the plaintiffs produced, a list of people who were part of what they called a class action against the opera for issuing or trying to issue this opera archive series. But interestingly, people who were on the class action suit, they said, "You use my name without my permission. I love this project. I want these performances out there. So take my name off the class action." Luckily for us, the plaintiffs never showed up in court. We had a court date set, and the time period came and went. Nothing ever came of the lawsuit, but the Opera Association, along with VAI and their lawyers, did come to an agreement. What saved us was the fact that the tapes were considered to have been made for archival purposes, that no one was recording them at the time for commercial gain, and secondly, that the opera orchestra that was used was a pickup orchestra. It was not a trademark name or a brand name such as Louisiana Philharmonic or New York Philharmonic. It was just what they called, in the parlance, I guess, of the people who played in it, a pickup band. So because of that, we felt we could continue with the project, But we had to end it when the orchestra then became the New Orleans Symphony and then later on the Louisiana Philharmonic. But everything came together so beautifully because when the orchestra ceased being a pickup band and then became the New Orleans Symphony, it was about the time they moved to the new theater when all the taping ceased anyway because the microphones didn't travel from the old theater to the new. So it all worked out very well. We didn't have any tapes to issue that used a different orchestra. We only had what was our pickup band, so we were able to proceed with the project. We had some great critical accolades. I love New Orleans Past Comes Alive and CD Player's Time Machine. Those were two of my favorites. We also had a couple of brickbats thrown at us. People didn't think we needed to issue these, that they weren't important, but we certainly did and continue to think that they were. We had some really good publicity. The opera sold the CDs through the mail, through their boutique, through their website, and they did a lot of nice brochures for us. And we made a lot of retired opera singers very happy. One little anecdote, Giuseppe Valdengo, who is in the La Boheme, came to New Orleans quite unannounced. And you know, singers have a tremendous talent and sometimes a very delightful ego to match. And Valdengo, bless his heart, thought that we had issued the Boheme just specifically to honor him and for no other reason. And he was so happy and enthused, so he showed up in New Orleans and we had a big party for him. And this was very much a good luck opera because so many years later, almost every cast member was still alive. So we assembled as many of the local people that we could to have a lunch. We played excerpts from the La Boheme, and it was very marvelous. And I'm glad that the dear man thought that we had done it to honor his performance. As I've stated earlier, prior to 1953, the tapes are from broadcast sources, AM broadcast radio. After that, they were from the microphones that, as you have seen, were usually in the proscenium. And the sound quality is amazing, particularly so that you get something that you don't get in a recording studio. You get the sense of space and amplitude from the voice traveling up to the microphone. And again, we had the good fortune that the microphones were left in place after the broadcasting ceased. And as far as I know, in the theater municipal auditorium that's being renovated now, the microphones may still be there in the exact same place. Now I'd like to let your ears be the judge. When I first agreed to come to do this presentation, Seth and I had a marvelous talk about the earliest recordings in the archive, which date from 1950, and was I sure that they were reel-to-reel tape and not possibly 78 RPM acetate recordings. And so I got one out. This is an unpublished recording of Bidou Sayal in Manon. And I made a tape excerpt that starts about 3 minutes to 5 minutes into the opera, where I think you would expect to hear a side break if it were to have been an acetate. And you don't hear any of the acetate swish that is so common on recordings of that era. So listen for yourself, an unpublished recording of Bidou Sayal in Manon, 1950. She repeated the role here a few years later, and that was probably the last performance of her career in that particular opera as well.
Thank you.
So I think you can safely say that this is an early reel-to-reel taped performance. And again, in 1950, it would have been an AM radio broadcast. To get back to Falstaff for a moment, that's one of the best examples of the sound restoration that was done on these original tapes. I'll play a short excerpt of the tape before it was restored and then after. Okay, then we'll hear the next excerpt. So what you hear is the voices are much brighter, clearer, the pitch is corrected, the hum has been removed, the hiss has been removed, and voila, we had something that was worthy of compact disc issuing. New Orleans got, at least the people who enjoyed recording of the operas for us, got stereo reel-to-reel tape recorders rather early. The first stereo tape performance that I have in the archive dates from 1958, and it's excerpts of La Traviata with Dorothy Kirsten. In 1959, they taped La Boheme in stereo, and interestingly, the performance that we issued was in mono, and then two or three years later, we were given a stereo tape of the same performance, and we issued it again with the byline, Newly Discovered Stereo Master. And I thought it'd be interesting to hear a little bit of what the mono and stereo versions sound like so you can get some idea of the microphone placement. And now in stereo. One of my favorite examples is what I call technical wizardry that I never thought possible. We have a 1960 performance of La Gioconda, and at the end of Act Two, there are cannon shots as part of the dramatic action, and they completely blow out the stage mic. And I thought that this would mean we could never issue it, but VAI came up with a way to do it. This is the original, unremastered. Here! I thought that was pretty amazing. Birgit Nilsson sang Turandot in New Orleans, and when we issued it on compact disc, she said in an interview that she feels that it was the closest she came, closest you could hear to how she actually sounded in the theater. She felt that our mics captured her voice better than the microphones of Decca or RCA Victor or Angel. And so I have a little excerpt of her commercial recording done for RCA Victor and then what you heard in New Orleans. Okay, and now we have same excerpt about 6 years later in New Orleans. I think that is totally amazing. Again, these were amateurs, hobbyists who just happened to love recording opera, and they could produce a Turandot recording like that that perhaps captured Birgit Nilsson's voice better than the sound engineers of RCA Victor at the Rome Opera House. The future of the New Orleans Opera Archive Project is basically that the tapes will be stored forever. They've been given to Loyola University from the opera. They are stored under climate control, as I've mentioned, and someday we hope to be able to announce that they are digitally available for folks to listen to. But until then, we're very grateful that they are there. I have two more excerpts that I would like to share with you. One is actually the only video that is in our collection, and this is an excerpt of Lucia de Lammermoor. We don't know why it was filmed, maybe for a TV program. It was never aired. It was on a kinescope, and it has the young Placido Domingo as Arturo. He was maybe 20 or 21 years old, Giuseppe Campora and Gianna D'Angelo, and the video quality is such, to me, it doesn't look much better than a Vitaphone, but it's very, very interesting that this tape exists of this performance from 1962.
Oh,
When Domingo came down to sing in the gala to reopen the Theater for Performing Arts, they played this on a big screen for the audience members to see. We do hopefully one day want to honor Domingo with a compact disc from the New Orleans Opera Archive series, and that compact disc we hope will be a 1968 performance of Il Trovatore with Montserrat Caballé, and was Domingo's first Manrico. There'll be a bonus disc of all the other performances that he sang, and they are all very well documented in our archive. I know that I've run a little over with time because there was so much music and hopefully good information to share. With cooperation with our technical wizard in the back, what I'd like to do is start the Trovatore selection and then maybe just keep the volume a little low so we could have Montserrat Caballé serenade us. And at the same time, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. So if you don't mind a little multitasking, it's been my pleasure to present to you this afternoon. And if there's any questions, something I didn't cover in the archive, I'm more than happy to answer them. And also, as you're filing out or wish to stay, you'll be able to hear the conclusion of this beautiful aria. Thank you very much.
Does anybody have any questions for George before we go on?
Yes, sir.
Not
with the opera. He sang several concerts, and those were actually captured because it was in the same venue that had the mic, so they recorded him. Domingo's first Andrea Chenier, which we have on tape, was actually supposed to be Corelli and Caballé, and they both abdicated the performance. I don't think Corelli even showed up in town, and I don't think she did either. So it ended up being... No, earlier than that, 66, 67, something around that time period.
Any other questions?
Okay, thank you very much.
George, I must say that was a pleasure.
I'm glad
you went over, because what you've done here is probably one of the most invaluable presentations that has been given at ARSC in a long time, representing an archive that to many of us only thought was up in the New York area in the sense of the Met or the City Opera, and that indeed there is opera outside of New York.
Yeah.
Who said yeah?
I did.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're from Washington, right, Brad? Chicago, well, that's another story unto itself.